is The Guardian.
We don't like a pope that's going to say that it's okay to have a nuclear weapon. We don't want a pope that says crime is okay in our cities. I don't like it. I'm not a big fan of Pope Leo. He's a very liberal person, and he's a man that doesn't believe in stopping crime.
I'm Reginald Ahmed.
I'm Jonathan Yaroshami.
And this is Decoding America. It's a new podcast from Guardian Australia. Well, Jonathan, we've got a blockade of the strait, failed negotiations with Iran, and an unprecedented war of words with the Pope.
Yeah, and what we saw is that even the Pope isn't above a cheeky clapback. He made a comment referring to Truth Social, that's the platform Trump posts on, calling the name ironic, but he also appeared to want to shut down that argument.
I don't want to get into a debate with him. I don't think that the message of the gospel is meant to be abused in the way that some people are doing.
It's unusual to hear the Pope when he's not in a homily. That's what I'm used to, him standing at the Vatican window. We're going to get to the blockade and the war in Iran in a moment, but we've just got to talk about this furious argument now happening. Maybe it's just a one-sided argument. But I know last week we talked about things getting pretty surreal, but I think we can say this sort of argument with the pontiff is pretty unprecedented.
Yeah, it's really unprecedented. And I don't think this has come totally in isolation. So for the last few months, Pope Leo has been saying a few things that clearly has, you know, raised Donald Trump's heckles. He's been quite critical of the war in Iran. He said over the weekend that there was a delusion of an omnipotence which was fueling the U.S.-Israel war in Iran. And that's quite an unusual thing for a pope to say as well, to be that out there. And it goes back even further. You might remember when Donald Trump launched his very brief war in Venezuela to capture Nicolas Maduro. The Pope was quite critical of that as well. And, you know, at other points he said that God doesn't listen to the prayers of people who wage war. He rejects them. And I think all of that together has really gotten Donald Trump a bit angry.
Donald Trump is known to be pretty thin-skinned. Why do you think this has got him particularly upset?
Well, and we're about to talk about this a bit later, but the war probably isn't going particularly as Donald Trump would like at the moment. There's clearly some issues that he needs to work through. But also, this is an American pope. This is the first ever American pope. And I think when it was announced that Pope Leo had the job last year after the death of Pope Francis, there was a lot of excitement in U.S. conservative circles that this would be an American pope. The two most powerful Americans in the world, Donald Trump, the president, Pope Leo now. And I think there was, I don't know, it's clear that it hasn't gone quite the way they would like. He's perhaps a little bit more liberal than they would have liked, but he's also the Pope. He's meant to be against things like war.
There's been a lot of reaction since then, but I'm not sure it was quite the reaction to Donald Trump's lashing of the Pope. It's more to do with an AI post.
Yeah, so just after he posted that criticism of Leo on social media, he posted an image that was clearly AI generated of himself as a Christ-like figure appearing to cure a man. He's surrounded by a lot of kind of very patriotic symbolism. There's a nurse and a soldier, there's flags, there's eagles, there's fighter jets. And
a demon? Some people are saying a demon in the
background. Yeah, I think I saw a demon in the background. I think that's one of the dangers of AI images, isn't it?
I'm wondering who taught Donald Trump, assuming he's done this himself as opposed to someone else who taught him to use AI.
Well, we know he didn't do it himself. We know that he took it from an Australian person, actually. So a MAGA Australian guy called Nick Adams, who's, you know, a real adherent to Donald Trump. Apparently he first posted this a few months ago and Donald Trump has since picked up on it. But, you know, it was in some ways just bizarre. But let's remember, America is a deeply religious country. I think it's really hard for a lot of us who live in nations that have perhaps become more secular over the last, you know, few decades. Religion and Christianity is still so important to people in America. They still have much higher levels of church attendance, for instance. And so this has been really, really controversial, and he's faced a huge amount of criticism with it. And yes, it's perhaps not surprising, he's now since deleted that post.
And that kind of religious interest in the US, I think it's just been elevated through the lens of this war, because we're hearing a lot of descriptions of the Iran war as some sort of holy conflict, especially from Peter Hegseth. He's really giving us that sense of the conflict with Iran through a religious lens.
Yeah, it's a crusade. So Pete Hegseth, the so-called Secretary of War, he held a prayer meeting last month focused on this war, and he said something like he was praying for overwhelming violence of action against those who deserve no mercy. That is biblical language. That is like something out of the Crusades a millennia ago. And, you know, Trump has been similar. He said, he was asked whether God approves of the war. He said, I do, because God is good and God wants to see people taken care of.
So in that sense, I'm kind of surprised at the conservative religious right reaction to these comments with the Pope, but especially to this AI image, because they do not like it.
No, it was a really strong reaction. So Riley Gaines, a Fox News podcast host, said that Trump would do well to reflect with a little humility. There were other really prominent Trump-supporting Christians who said, you know, you're not God. This goes against everything we believe in and crosses the line. A guy, a conservative writer who attended the Catholic baptism of J.D. Vance, who is a recent convert to Catholicism, he said that that image radiated the spirit of the Antichrist. Now, Trump has said he's got nothing to apologize for, but he's clearly taken some of this criticism on board.
He deleted the post. He hasn't apologized to the Pope, but we've got to listen to how he justified this AI image.
It's supposed to be me as a doctor making people better, and I do make people better. I make people a lot better.
It's supposed to be me as a doctor. What do you think about that?
I think our audience will have to make up their own mind. I encourage them to Google the image and see what they think. That, you know, the post was part of a very busy night of social media for Donald Trump, and I think that is reflective of something a bit broader. So I had a look through his Truth Social account this morning. I wouldn't encourage anyone would do that at home, but I had to do it for professional reasons. And what I found...
You're taking a bullet for us.
Yeah, it's, you know, I'm taking a sacrifice.
Thank you.
He posted an image of himself as this kind of Christ-like figure. That was just about before 10 p.m. Washington time. He then posted 11 times between then and 4 a.m. So throughout the night, he's posting AI images of a Trump Tower on the moon. He's posting memes. He's posting news clips. He's posting stuff about his blockade of the Strait of Hormuz. He's posting other political things. He's posting about Joe Biden. He's posting about his ballroom. And he's doing that about once an hour, once every half hour until 4 a.m. When does he sleep?
Does he sleep? He famously doesn't seem to need a lot of rest.
No, but I guess what that shows is that he's clearly head up about something and he's kind of posting through it, as I think the kids say. But, you know, it's all part of this really curious relationship that Trump has with religion. Trump is such an important figure to the evangelical right in America. They supported him so much. He got the majority of votes of U.S. Catholics as well in 2024. But I think it's not really clear what Donald Trump himself personally believes. He's clearly got no problems comparing himself to Christ. It's not the first time we've seen him do it. I was really struck reading about this last night that there's a kind of really important Christian figure in the US who, when Trump was first running in 2016, was kind of trying to make peace with the fact that this man was a bit out there, he was a bit rambunctious, but he was going to be the figure to, you know, give evangelical Christians everything they want. And he said that Donald Trump may not be as good with the Bible as others. He may not have read the Bible. In fact, he may not have ever read the Bible, but he will be a strong messenger for us. And I think that was the issue, that they found that even though he didn't embody everything they might want in a leader, in a Christian sense, they knew they could do business with him.
That's a really important point, because there were past controversies that a lot of the sort of religious right seemed to excuse with Donald Trump, things that wouldn't necessarily represent, you would say, Christian values. I guess we're going to have to see if this is a turning point. to that supporter group.
Yeah, clearly something has happened here because he has backed down and we know how rare that is.
All right, well, I'm not sure how long that outrage over the Pope and AI pictures will last, but I'm not going to be able to let go of that image of Trump posting through it that you've just given me. It's like instead of verbal processing, it's social media processing of his thoughts. But let's turn to some quite serious issues. We still have a war going on. Now we have a blockade of the Strait of Hormuz, which arguably will have quite an enduring effect on the world, as opposed to controversies with the Pope. Let's just have a listen to some of how Donald Trump is characterizing his relationship with the Strait.
You know, we don't get our oil from there. We have so much oil. We have boats pouring up to the United States. They'll be filling them up and they'll be leaving, and they're going to be packed with the best oil you can get, light sweet crude. They're going to have the best oil that you can get.
Light sweet crude. You know, whatever you say about Donald Trump, he's still got a bit of a way with words. But last week he was talking about open the F Strait in an, you know, expletive laden post. Now it's the complete opposite. He's blockading it.
Yeah, well, this is all part of the journey that we're on with Donald Trump, isn't it? You and I spoke a week ago, didn't we? And
a million years ago.
He was threatening to target bridges and infrastructure, and we were saying, could this amount to war crimes? And just look what's happened since then. He agreed a ceasefire with Iran. He said negotiations were quite far along with Iran. He said the Middle East is entering a new golden age. He sent his vice president to negotiations in Pakistan. Those negotiations ended after less than a day. He promised to impose a blockade, and then he threatened to target bridges and infrastructure again. So we've come full circle.
I mean, Donald Trump said with this blockade, it'll U.S. vessels will blow ships to hell if they're trying to get through. But this blockade has come in now as of midnight our time. What's actually happening, do we know?
We know very little at the moment, and we really don't know how it's going to operate because, yes, it's one thing to threaten to blow vessels to hell, but think about the environmental impact of that. So these tankers are full of millions of litres of oil. That's an environmental disaster, and it's an economic disaster for the Strait. So it's they're clearly not going to do that. How are they going to do that?
Yeah.
So how will they enforce it? Well, they might use destroyers, U.S. Navy destroyers, to chase down these tankers and take them over. We've seen them do this in the past.
Board them, you mean.
Exactly, yep. Board them. And we saw that in Venezuela. That's going to be a really difficult operation. And then we've got the other issue of he's saying that we're just going to target Iranian vessels. We're going to try and cut off what is a really important, you know, source of revenue to Iran, which is their oil. But we're going to allow other tankers from the Gulf. Well, I feel like Iran probably won't be up for that. And they might start targeting those vessels, as we know they've done throughout this conflict. And so we're in a position where we might be seeing even less oil on the market if this blockade goes through as he's promised.
And we did hear Donald Trump say we don't need the oil from the Strait. And I did some research, and it's true, the US doesn't take a lot of oil from the Strait, but this might be a whole other discussion, but they still need fertilizer coming out of there. So they still need, they still have some reliance on the Strait.
Well, and not just that. Oil prices are set in a global market. It doesn't matter if you are a sovereign creator of oil as the US is. The US is the biggest producer of oil in the world. But the prices of their oil are set through the global market. So whatever the price of, you know, Brent crude in Australia is, that's going to be the same in the US. And if there is this, you know, shortage of supply, that hits everyone at the same level, which means that people in America will still be paying more for their oil and their petrol. And I think what's really interesting about this blockade, one of the questions I've been getting from people is, why didn't he do this before? Why didn't he cut off their revenue before?
Well, why not?
Well, one of the reasons is because he was facing a huge supply shortage of oil. And one of the ways to get around that is to allow Iran to export some of their oil, to just, you know, flood the market with a bit more. It's one of those weird ironies of this war that he's pounding this country, but at the same time, they're making more from oil than at any point in years because he's lifted sanctions on them while he's at war with them so that they can more easily sell their oil. And that's great for Iran. And it's one of those things that, you know, we always look at why various governments haven't been harder on the Russian oil market, for instance, after their invasion of Ukraine, why they haven't been harder on Iran prior to this war. And it's because it's kind of a catch-22. Yes, you can cut off their supplies and you can cut off the revenue that these countries get from selling oil, but that hits all of us because that's less oil in the market generally, and that we know about supply and demand, pushes prices up for everyone. So every US administration has always really carefully calibrated this. They've been very careful not to hit these countries too hard so that they can't sell their oil at all, because that could be a disaster for the market more generally.
You mentioned the negotiations. I was really struck by a line from Patrick Wintour's reporting in The Guardian that made an impact and just explained how Iran was viewing the Strait. He quoted a member of the Iranian parliament saying, "The Strait of Hormuz is something beyond the atomic bomb for us, an atomic bomb that operates continuously on a global level." He was making that point in the sense of the strategy for Iran. I mean, what does that say about why these negotiations might have failed?
Well, it tells us that this war has taught Iran that they have one of the most powerful tools of economic leverage of almost any country in the world. Through an accident of geography, they sit on this vital waterway through, let's remember, up to 20% of the world's oil passes through every day in normal times. And with drones, with a guy in a speedboat, with a bomb, with really low-tech things that would never stand up to the multi-billion dollar budget of the US Navy, they can cause huge economic chaos. And that is a weapon, a piece of leverage, that they're just not going to give over lightly.
And they know it. Right. So we saw these talks fail. We've heard a lot about how Donald Trump doesn't want Iran to have nuclear weapons, and that might be a bit of an element to it. But how, did you see J.D. Vance and his demeanor when he came out and announced after 21 hours that those talks had failed? He does seem like a man with a big burden.
J.D. Vance has been given a real poison pill here because he has been given the responsibility for negotiating these talks. Donald Trump joked the other week, if a deal doesn't happen, I'm blaming J.D. Vance. If it does happen, I'm taking full credit. And that's a joke, but it's also kind of going to be true.
It's a kernel of truth.
Yeah, I think probably more than a kernel. And so J.D. Vance went into this, and let's be real, they negotiated for 21 hours. That is a marathon session. There were hundreds of diplomats from Iran and the U.S. coming in to do this. When Barack Obama negotiated the nuclear deal that he agreed with Iran in 2015, those negotiations went on for 2 years. What did they think they were going to achieve in a day when, let's, you know, as well as the Strait, we've got a bunch of other issues. We've got the issue of the support for Iranian proxies around the region. Iran wants the US to leave a lot of their bases in the region. They want sanctions lifted on them. They want a lot of their assets that have been frozen overseas unfrozen. And the biggest thing, the reason this conflict started, is there is no agreement over whether Iran has the right to enrich uranium.
Well, and what struck me about the negotiations is here is Donald Trump of the United States negotiating for something they already had before the war.
Yeah, and so much of what they're negotiating is at cross purposes as well. And I think it comes down to this idea that Donald Trump is still negotiating like he's a real estate magnate in New York and not someone who can order airstrikes in a foreign country. And I always wonder, you know, are those transferable skill sets? How did he go from being, you know, a real estate guy in New York to being someone who's deciding to go to war with a foreign country? And I think the approach that Trump and by extension his negotiation teams take is like dealing with a building contractor who's failed to come in on budget. It's not how you treat a sovereign country.
Yeah, and you get that feeling when Iran has said on the record they failed to gain our trust. There's a mismatch there.
Exactly. And look, he's had some success in the past with tariffs. He came in really hard on Europe and countries in Asia and got some really good deals for America. But mostly what we see is Donald Trump negotiates in a zero-sum fashion. Either they win or I win. And he doesn't want to lose.
I can't help but see this whole negotiation through the lens of a particular piece that we both read and were really taken by. It took us inside the room and gave us this idea of how J.D. Vance was probably the one that was strongest against the war, a real insight into perhaps the decision-making that went into this.
Yeah, so this was a piece published by the New York Times last week, and it was written by two of their journalists who we know have some of the best insight and contacts within Trump world, basically. It was Jonathan Swan and Maggie Haberman. They've become iconic figures in reporting on Donald Trump. And what was extraordinary about this piece is, yes, they outlined the case that Netanyahu made to the Trump team to launch the war. You know, he said that there would be near certain victory. Iran's ballistic missile program would be destroyed in a few weeks. He didn't believe that they would manage to choke off the Strait of Hormuz. And he said that there was a likelihood that the regime would be overthrown. And, you know, we know how that all turned out in the end. After he made that case, people in Trump's inner circle were very suspicious of some of his claims. We know from this piece that, for instance, the CIA director said that Netanyahu's ambitions were farcical, that's a quote, and it gave us such an incredible insight into the decision-making in the White House. But more than that, it raises the question of who's telling these journalists all these incredible details.
Where is this coming from? Because up till now, Trump 2.0 has been pretty leak-proof.
Yeah, I mean, think back to the first administration from 2016. We now know that Donald Trump didn't expect to win that election. And he wasn't really prepared for building up an administration and staff around him. And so he kind of did what the Republican Party said. And he took on, yes, some of his own people, but a lot of kind of just very standard Republican officials in all of those roles in cabinet and in the White House. And they were all at odds with each other. And what we saw is so much leaking. So we saw in the first year, especially, almost every day, U.S. media would be reporting incredible details from inside the White House. But this time around, Donald Trump has surrounded himself with loyalists. He knows that he can't afford to have people leaking.
And you get that sense because no one, in terms of loyalists, because no one outright said, if that reporting is accurate, don't do this. This is going to be a nightmare. Please don't do this, Mr. President.
Well, I mean, one of the interesting things in terms of the accuracy of the report is that they even go as far as to tell us the seating plan in the Situation Room. That is the most closed-off classified space in the White House.
That's your way of saying it's probably pretty accurate, we can assume.
I mean, the fact that they can tell us who J.D. Vance was sitting next to and who Marco Rubio was sitting
next
to is an astonishing level of detail. And I think what it tells us is that people in that room, and we don't know who they are clearly speaking to the media. And they want to get ahead of whatever is going to come out from this Iran war. It's clearly not going as they might have hoped, and they're now trying to get their cases on record. So we've got comments in that piece from Marco Rubio, from J.D. Vance, from others who, if the piece is to be believed, express some skepticism of the war. And who knows who spoke to these journalists, but if the fact that that information is out there indicates that people want on record what they were saying going into this.
You're thinking perhaps with an eye to the next election.
Well, look, we know Marco Rubio and J.D. Vance definitely are interested in being president, and those are the names most often spoken about as the people who might be running for the Republican Party. So, you know, J.D. Vance clearly was very against this conflict going into it. I don't think there's many people who disagree with that. And he wants that on the record now.
All right, very briefly before we get to the break, a room of a different kind where Trump and Rubio were during these negotiations, and it was at the UFC. How many metaphors can you come up with on that?
It was bizarre, wasn't it? So as Vance was telling the world that negotiations had broken down in Pakistan, Donald Trump is making his entrance into the Ultimate Fighting Championship event, and he's there with Marco Rubio, who, let's remember, is the chief diplomat of the United States, and I don't know, I think it's been suggested maybe might have had bigger things to worry about.
And there's pictures of them sort of talking. I can only assume they were getting updates potentially from Islamabad.
Well, one would hope so. We know, for instance, that J.D. Vance spoke to Trump multiple times during those negotiations. So it's not unreasonable to believe that, but who knows?
I saw one BBC journalist write, comparing that event to the war on Iran, at least UFC has rules and a defined endpoint.
Yeah. Well, and look, remember, UFC is a really important thing in Trump world. We are, I think, 2 or 3 months away from a UFC Freedom 250 event. That is a event marking the 250th anniversary of the United States, a very important anniversary happening this year.
Wow.
And they're going to be holding a cage match on the White House lawn.
It's central to MAGA and the Trump administration. All right, let's go to a break. When we come back, a quiet warning from the White House on having a flutter.